B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
And as you read the Rust in Peace book and you realize how messed up we were on drugs and now I've been sober 3 decades, now you know why. I got a lot of energy now.
Megadeth bassist David Ellefson is my guest today in the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast as they're celebrating the 30th anniversary of what some say is a thrash classic. The book, Rust in Peace, the inside story of a Megadeth masterpiece, is out as well. And yes, there's a lot of talk about substance abuse, and it's a miracle this album was even made.
So that scene in the dirt where, you know, Nikki has the guy shoot him up, and there's kind of a slash-looking guy laying on the couch, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think it's portrayed to be him. And literally right next door is where me and Steven and Fred Curry were. Just drinking beers and, well, kind of yucking it up.
We talk about the writing process, other guitar players they tried to bring into the band, if there was any leftover material, maybe for Countdown to Extinction. And how about the pressure put on by another band called Metallica, who was having gigantic success at the time?
We are all just a branch off the Metallica family tree. I mean, let's face it, those guys, you know, especially Megadeth, with Dave being there and then me being a branch off of Dave with Megadeth.
Megadeth's David Ellefson is my guest today on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Hey, thank you as always for checking out the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Meltdown back at it again. Rust in Peace, the inside story of the Megadeth masterpiece. Is this a new book by Dave Mustaine? Talks about the withdrawals, the growing pains, everything that came about as far as this classic thrash metal album. And I was fortunate enough about, 3 or 4 months ago to record Chuck Buehler's part for the audio book. And so I got to read the book early. And so it's really interesting. And the thing that really struck me, and Dave talks a lot about it here in the interview today, is just the substance abuse these guys were under before the recording process and before the record came out. So it's a really interesting story, and there's some great rock star stories in this conversation today with David Ellefson. So he talks about the dirt, like we mentioned in the beginning of the intro, as well as a rock star whose phone call he took, although he was perplexed as to take this rock star's phone call or to take his drug dealer's phone call back in the day. That was a pivotal moment in David's life as well. So we'll get into that coming up here in just a few minutes. A great conversation, like I said, with David Ellefson. Hey, real fast, before we start, if you like this podcast, make sure you subscribe to it. I've got some pretty cool interviews coming down the pike here in the next couple of weeks. Some already scheduled that I'm looking forward to talking to. And, of course, you can follow me on the socials if you're out there in the world of social media at Meltdown WRIF. In the meantime, let's start this interview with David Ellefson from Megadeth, the guy who I've gotten to know over the last couple of years. Just a super good guy. And I met him actually through my friend Bumblefoot, who I actually asked a question from Bumblefoot near the end of this interview, which is kind of funny. So as always, we start the interview off by thanking the artist for taking the time and taking the time to call in and hang out and tell their story.
Sure, of course, man. You know, and it's funny, there's a lot of, you know, you and I, it's interesting. Over the last couple of years, you and I have always been in pretty close proximity on a number of things between me and Frank Bello and now Megadeth and this new book, and Chuck Buehler and all kinds of fun stuff. So it's been a fun little journey with you and Riff over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I appreciate the friendship for sure. I love getting those text messages. It's funny because I'm always afraid to text you because I'm not sure. Are you one of those guys that sleeps with your phone by the bed, or is it somewhere? Like, I always put mine in the kitchen. Like, people can text me anytime they want. It's always on silent, so it doesn't really matter to me.
Yes, I am that guy.
Okay.
I feel great joy when Apple sends me the, your screen time was down by 10% this week. You know, they give me these notifications. I feel like I'm bettering myself as a human, you know, when I'm on my phone less.
Well, I know that you're always like 3 hours behind me. So I'm like, I'll wake up at 9 o'clock. I'm like, I don't know, should I text them back? It's 6 a.m. there. But it's like, you know, with me, I'm always in and out of studios. So I always have my phone on silent because I'm sure that the time I don't have it on, I'm going to forget about it. I'm going to be on the air talking and my phone's going to go off or something, you know.
I am the same way, man. I've had my phone on silence like probably for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
That's no kidding. You know what I mean? It's, because first of all, my family will look at me crazy because I, you know, pretty much work out of the home, if you will. And of course, when I'm on tour, you know, then you're on at tight quarters in the yellow submarine on the tour bus. And if you got four or five phones going off, everybody will be looking at you like, what the hell are you doing over there, dude? You know? So yeah, I feel it's better to be a little more covert, you know, in your, you know, phone time. And I am the same way, man. You can hit me anytime. Plus I'm an early riser, man. I mean, I get up, I mean, you know, we have 364 days of sun out here in Arizona. So believe me, I'm up early and now biking and doing stuff. So hit me anytime.
Well, let me ask you about this because I just posted this on my Twitter. So are you a, like for me, I'm like a untangled cord headphone guy. Are you one of those guys, like I'm like kind of anal about it. My cord cannot be tangled. Are you just like throw the headphones on and just go?
No, my gosh, I am the same way. In fact, I've got a couple of stations. So my home office has essentially become, you know, it's my workplace. And if I face, like if we were on Zoom right now, the desk I'm sitting at, you'd basically see a, you know, a bookcase full of all sorts of just stuff, you know, just cram, you know. I come home off tour and my house just explodes with more clothes, books, just stuff, right? And no, and it doesn't seem to end up anywhere except in my office. So, but if I turn, and I've now set up my office so that if I turn 45 degrees to the other wall, then behind me is, you know, a bunch of gold and platinum records, and it looks like a rock star's kind of showroom museum, you know?
Right.
And that's where I do like my Zoom and my StreamYard calls because it looks like, wow, okay, this guy's like a real rock star, you know? But the desk I'm sitting at here right now, you'd think I'm just some schmo, you know, sitting in my basement at my mom's house, you know, just doing work, you know? So, well, you know, so, and with that said, I've got two sets of headphones, right? So one is set up, you know, on like a little Focusrite thing so I can do proper streams and it sounds good and it looks good and everything. But then, and over here on this other desk is where I play bass. I've recorded this new No Cover record, a lot of my solo stuff. When I'm practicing, I'm at this desk I'm talking to you on right now. And yeah, these are straight cords, no curly cords. The 70s are over. You know, like plug the stuff in. And yeah, I like things to be neat. And especially when you're, you know, when you're wired for sound and you're playing and you're practicing or something, I hate cables. And it's inevitable because things have to be plugged in. That's an electric guitar. And, you know, but it's like, I hate when like you turn the bass and suddenly you yank the headphones off your head. Right?
Yeah, I mean, know. Yeah.
That thing, right? So, and it just puts me in a bad mood, and then I get pissed off, and you know.
Well,
so, you know, yeah.
I don't play bass. I don't play bass, but when I'm outside cutting my grass in my zero turn and I hit a tree or something and it rips the head, you know, the earbuds out because I still have the cords.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God. I know this. It's like, it's like nothing annoys me more.
Well, I've gone through about three sets of Apple AirBuds and, you know, they're a couple hundred bucks, you know,
yeah.
And you know, the first one, you know, you pull one out of your ear and it just slips through your hand and you drop it and you're like, all right, well, where did that go? Like, and then you're looking around. I don't know if it was like on an airplane or in a car, whatever. I remember one I left behind in an Uber when I was on tour last summer. I was doing some solo dates and I took like an Uber to this little airport in, I don't know, Cleveland or no, it was a small airport, so it couldn't have been Cleveland, but somewhere. And I remember I got out and it's one of those things when you get out, you slam the door and the car drives away and it hits you right then.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot, my earbuds are in there. So, you know, after spending, you know, $1,000 on earbuds, I'm back to a cable again because it just seems like these crappy little, you know, cables that come with your iPhone, like they don't lose. You can't lose them. It's like cheap sunglasses. You can't
right.
break them. You can't lose them. They're just with you for life, you know?
Exactly. When you were talking about the cords and stuff, it just reminded me, I saw Bob Dylan once, and it was one of the worst shows I've ever seen for numerous reasons. First of all, I'm not a Bob Dylan fan, but I went with one of my friends, and it was the last time I was ever in Joe Louis Arena. It's a Saturday in the middle of summer, and out here in Detroit, you only have so many, you know, 85, 80 degree Saturdays in the middle of summer to spend, and I'm inside Joe Louis Arena watching Bob Dylan. And the stage, yeah, right. The stage was like a friggin' mess. There's like microphones and wires all over the place. I could not get over that. I've never seen a stage like that before.
Yeah, this ain't the Grateful Dead and it ain't Woodstock. It's like, clean this stuff up. You know, this is, you know. Well, it's funny, you know, speaking of Megadeth, rest in peace.
Yeah.
You know, we always have had a clean stage, but that was a year, 1990, where everything was going to be arenas and bigger halls. You know, we were out with Judas Priest in North America. We did Clash of the Titans with Slayer, Testament, Suicidal. That was in Europe. And that was, you know, arenas. And then we came over here and we did the Sheds, you know, so like, what is now, I guess, the DTE Center,
right,
by
right.
You know, so it's, you know, big rooms, you know, so, and, you know, so it's like, you want things to be clean and quite honestly, you get on big stages and like your basic 20-foot cable from Guitar Center doesn't even work on that stage because you need a 50-foot cable, which you have to have somebody in Hollywood make because it's, you know, it's a professional level thing. So, you know, everything kind of goes to this next level. And I remember, you know, Dave and Marty Friedman, there's a new guy in LA, Bradshaw was his name. And he would make these, you know, very high-end pedal boards and rack equipment. And you know, we were, you know, Megadeth being the state-of-the-art speed metal band, as our manager called us back in 1987.
Right.
You know, we've kind of always been on the front edge of technology and how do we make things cleaner and better. And you know, I remember on that tour, you know, that was a, like, basically no cable, you know, stage. Dave and Marty would still have these pedal boards in front of them, so they would kind of hit a pedal to like maybe boost their volume for like a lead solo or something. But you know, then actually I remember on Countdown to Extinction, I think their Countdown or maybe Euthanasia, like even those went off the stage, and then we started having the guitar techs doing the punches on the side of the stage, so they everything was super clean, you know?
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
love that. I love that, man. You're not tripping over stuff. You know, it's funny. I remember, like, probably the first rock magazine I bought when I was a kid, you know, over in Jackson, Minnesota, as a teenager, was Hit Parader magazine. On the cover was The Who, and a killer rock star photo of Roger Daltrey. But next to him, of course, Pete Townsend, and he had this like curly cord going back to his amp. And I'm thinking, I have one of those, and I'm like a kid in Jackson, Minnesota. Like, there has to be something bigger in the big leagues of rock stardom, right? Like, Kiss doesn't use curly cords. Come on, kick this up a notch, you know?
That is funny, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, we could talk about gear all day because I don't know anything about it. I could just ask you questions about it all day. But let me ask you about this, first of all, before we get into Rust in Peace, and we'll talk for 3.5 hours about what you have coming up because you're always doing something. I'm just
sure.
kidding. I texted David, for those that obviously nobody knows, but I texted him like, hey, can we talk about Rust in Peace for 3.5 minutes and what you're doing right now for an hour and a half? Because you're like the busiest guy I know.
I'm blessed to be productive.
That's right.
And as you read the Rust in Peace book and you realize how messed up we were on drugs and now I've been sober 3 decades, now you know why. I got a lot of energy now.
Man.
I can be more productive now, you know.
Well, we'll get into that here in a second. But first of all, it was Dave's birthday over the weekend. So what do you do for the guy that has everything?
Well, you know, I called him. I gave him a call. In fact, we've been talking about some lyric stuff for the new album. So I'd finished up a little lyric thing. I sent it over to him and gave him a call. And just, you know, with us, it's always a business conversation as well as friends, you know. And, and I think if anything, we try to find more moments where we can just kind of have friend conversations. Hey, how's the family? You know, he talked about his son Justice, my son Roman, you know, what's kind of going on around the house and, you know, hey, how's the wife, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, because, you know, it's easy to just default to talking about music and, you know, album concepts and stuff. But it was, yeah, we had a wonderful chat. It was really great. And, you know, he had just done these little promo things for the new Rust in Peace book. So, you know, he's, you know, you could tell he was happy. He was feeling really good. And you know, we're recording right now. We're on the album 16, as we call it, till we have the title of the new Megadeth album. So, you know, yeah, it was good. It was nice to just, you know, Sunday, day off for Dave, day off for me. So we could just kind of sit and chat about a myriad of topics. But I tell you what, it was an invigorating conversation because it just reminds me, you know, when I talked to Dave and he was really starting to get into his zone on lyrics and concepts of the we've had these songs, you know, written, titles even in place, and just kind of, you know, now filling in sort of the detail of the lyric. And it, you know, it just reminds me why I've been hanging with him for the last 37 years. You know, there's he just operates on another level. He's on another plane of existence. And I've always said guys like Dave are like too big for planet Earth, you know, so they're always kind of they're sort of almost extraterrestrial, you know. They're out here in different dimensions, and that's what makes Dave so compelling and just a really magnetic person to be around, you know, because you're like, you know, I don't have another friend like you. Like, you're the only one like this, you know. I got other friends who are stockbrokers and sell real estate and do kind of, you know, the normal things of this earth. And then you've got a guy like Dave who is not of this earth. He's on another level. And I'm proud to have him as a friend. And it's certainly been wonderful to saddle up next to him as a bandmate.
Now, when you guys had your falling out back in the early 2000s, there had to always been a part in your brain where you're like, we're going to be back together eventually, right?
There was, absolutely. I knew, and that was why it was, and quite honestly, you know, when Dave and I just talk, everything's fine, you know, and that was just a weird season where, you know, it was new regime, new manager, new attorney, and, you know, these guys, well, we're just doing what we're told, and it's like, but you guys are idiots, like, this is not how we do things, you know?
Yeah.
Me and Dave have been together, like, we're the founders, the owners, like, at some point, common sense has to come together that, you know, that you don't just do whatever your client on a whim may say, or you fill in the blanks of things. It's like, you should be working to bring people together, not celebrating, pushing them apart. And, you know, and again, and it just goes to show after only what, 5 years, he and I were back together again, you know, and most of those people were out, you know, the manager was gone and, you know, and those people were out. And, you know, it's weird in our world because there's always this sort of fanboy thing that goes on. And I don't care how much of a professional you are. And we're all fans. I mean, we're all fans of somebody, and our business is driven by celebrity. And some people get around that and they kind of just lose their senses, you know, and they suddenly get caught up in the, well, maybe I'll be his favorite person, you know, and I'll just do whatever they say and I'll be here forever. And they kind of get addicted to this. There's this euphoric rush that is around that, you know, and we all know it because we all have our fan, our celebrities we're fans of. And it's that moment when you're in the room with them, you kind of go, oh my God, like, this is just a surreal moment. And I think if anything, I'm probably more of the guy that tries to de-escalate that, you know, like when we do our VIP meet and greets and things, I try to de-escalate that to just say, hey, you know, look him in the eye, give him a handshake and make a human connection. And I think that's kind of my role in Megadeth because Dave is very much the one, you know, he is the one who kind of sits up on the silver cloud, you know, and that's his role in the band. That's who he is. He gives off that magnetic, you know, aura about him, you know, and I think that is, it really kind of defines our two roles, you know, is Dave brings the, you know, rock God part of it, and I bring the humanity of it. And between us, it makes this band called Megadeth.
Yeah, and you guys are kind of like, and to a certain degree, like the Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of the metal world, perhaps.
We kind of are. I mean, we kind of are. And I think when you read this book, you'll go, oh my God, these two were the toxic twins. You know,
that's true. Well, yeah.
I always say that back in that day, you know, in L.A., there was Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, and Megadeth. And while our music was different and we kind of spoke to three separate little genres, our lifestyles were synonymous. They were exactly the same.
Yes.
And, you know, to the degree that, you know, the night that Nikki overdosed and died, it's funny, I actually went up to the hotel, it was at Franklin Plaza, where Guns N' Roses were staying. And me and Steven Adler were buddies. So I went up there, hang out, and Fred Curry from Cinderella was actually filling in playing drums at these couple shows for Guns N' Roses because Steven broke his arm. So we're just hanging out, and Fred's a wonderful guy and just a kind of a real good, normal sort of dude. And you know, then Nikki and Slash come barging in our room, you know, late at night looking for, you know, products of illicit use.
Now, just so people know, this is because I've talked to Slash about this before. This was the scene in the dirt, right? I mean, this is like,
this is
right around that same time. So go ahead.
Yep. So that scene in the dirt where, you know, Nikki has the guy shoot him up and there's kind of a Slash looking guy laying on the couch, right?
Yeah.
Well, that I think is portrayed to be him because literally right next door is where me and Steven and Fred Curry were just drinking beers and, you know, kind of yucking it up. And Slash and Nikki had been in our room literally minutes before this before that scene. And I didn't know Slash that well. But I knew we'd met before, but I didn't know him that well. And I'd never met Nicky. That was my first exposure to him. I was like, whoa, look out. Like, this guy's on a tear, you know? And then literally, you know, minutes later, you know, a girl comes screaming, running, knocking on it. Oh my God, get some ice. Nicky's OD'd. He's in the bathtub. Get some ice. And, you know, Fred looks at me and goes, you got a car? Get me the hell out of here. I don't need this crap. You know, cause, you know, Fred's just a hired guy for a weekend to play some shows, you know? You know, so the irony of that, you know, going from Nicky, you know, literally dying, you could hear the helicopters and the police coming. And I mean, you could hear the whole thing going on, you know, and as we're leaving, you know, to get out of there, and you know, it seemed like the situation, you know, there's enough people there freaking out, calling the cops and the ambulance and stuff, that, you know, the irony that then, that McGee Entertainment, who managed Motley Crue at that time, would within a few months start managing Megadeth. And that was, and this is in the Rust in Peace book, you know, that was when we transitioned to, you know, coming off all the drugs ourselves and getting cleaned up. And when me and Dave were in rehab, like probably 9 months later, you know, Nicky came out to see us and stone cold sober, looking like $1 million, man. And it's just the nicest guy, you know, Nicky, when he's clean as he is now, I mean, he is just a wonderful human being,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And, you know, pulls up in his Lambo and all buffed out. And, you know, just, they were getting ready to start cutting the tracks for the Dr. Feelgood record. And, you know, here, me and Dave were coming off So Far So Good, So What, and, you know, not looking so good and, you know, needing to make that transition, which, you know, again, for us, 18 months later, we would then make that transition into sobriety and cut the Rust in Peace record and, you know, kind of follow a similar path to how Motley did. You know, once we got clean, man, the world was our oyster. And the Aerosmith guys had just been through that, you know, Steven and Joe and those guys had gotten cleaned up right before the Motley guys had. In fact, I remember Steven was kind of a mentor, you know, to a lot of us, you know. He had called me one day. I was sitting at home, ironically waiting for the drug dealer to call, and I pick up the phone and it's Steven Tyler. And I'm, you know, this is a moment I'm torn, going, my hero is on the phone, but I'm waiting for my dealer to call. Mm. Like, these are both important calls. Which one takes precedent, you know? And,
yeah.
And if you're a drug addict, you know, listening to this, you know that. And I mean, that was a, talk about a pivotal moment in my life, just going, oh my gosh, like, who have I become? Like, I have really lost the plot here, you know? And, you know, had a really wonderful chat with Steven. And, you know, a few years later, we were on tour together with Aerosmith. You know, and I talked to him about that. I said, hey, I don't know if you remember making this call, but you called me. And, you know, I just want to let you know I'm like 3 years clean now. And, you know, thanks for the inspiration. You know, I just let you know, like, I'm one that the call seemed to have worked. So thank you. You know, so it's nice to, you know, let him know that.
Now, was that the actual linchpin that got you sober? And what is, do you have a sober date, or do you, or I don't know if you talk about this stuff or not. I don't know.
Yeah. March 1st, 1990 is my sobriety date.
Wow.
So,
just past 30 years, man. Wow.
Yeah. 30 years. Yeah. It's really been a blessing. And yeah, I mean, you know, we made this pact. I mean, really in 1989, as we did this song, No More Mr. Nice Guy, which is the Alice Cooper cover.
Yeah.
We did it for a Wes Craven movie called Shocker, and we were just, I mean, that was really the bottom. I mean, Nick Menza had just come into the band as our drummer, so we were really just a three-piece when we recorded the track and shot the video. We had a new manager named Ron Lafitte who had come in, and he had a great sensibility and real candor and care for us, and you know, he really got Megadeth. He understood Dave, and he went to great lengths to really kind of get down in the trenches with us, and yet was very professional. And you know, I remember one day coming home from the dealer's house, and I mean, I just remember breaking down in tears, and I just said, man, I got to get clean, man. And he told me, he said, he goes, listen, if you really want this, I'll do everything I can to help you, but you have to really want it. And I just said, yep, I'm throwing in the towel. I'm ready to go. And he got us a band counselor, this little Hispanic guy who looked like Yosemite Sam, who was like 5 years sober. And, he used to rob banks and do all kinds of stuff that like troublemaker junkies did, but he was 5 years sober and ran the Beverly Hills Medical Center Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, and he brought him in, and Dave would see him a couple days a week. I'd see him a couple days a week. We would do band meetings one day a week. You know, that's why people talk about the Metallica movie, Saint Anger. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's old hat. We did that 20 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
We've already been down that road. But, you know, and Ron, you know, he mentored under Tim Collins, who was the manager of Aerosmith. And, you know, so he mentored under him and would ask him, like, how did you get the Aerosmith guys clean? And you know, heard, of course, all the harrowing stories, and Ron had his own harrowing stories with us. And, you know, I think that, and of course, this, you know, during this period, we were writing the Rest in Peace album. It was getting harder and harder to get to rehearsal, to be productive, because we were so strung out and just such a mess. And, you know, it literally takes a village to raise, you know, to raise a child, you know, and when you're coming out of addiction, you're a kid, man. You're like an infant starting life all over again, you know? And, you know, so it's amazing that any one of us were able to do it, let alone, you know, all of us together, because me and Dave were the addicts. We were getting clean. Nick Menza was just kind of a drink a Corona, have a party, you know, kind of a happy Valley dude.
Right.
And Marty Friedman comes into the band, and he's just going, oh, my God, like, I just wanted to play guitar. Like, now I have to go to drug and alcohol counseling meetings. And, you know, but Marty was, you know, Marty, he said, he goes, you know, I've been gunslinging solo for a while, and I'm cool with just showing up and playing guitar in someone else's band right now. I'm okay with that, you know. So he, you know, I was like, well, look, welcome to the big time. You know, this is what it's going to take. But, you know, that's why that record and that book, and thank you, by the way, for helping. You helped Chuck Beeler read his parts, our former drummer who lives there in Detroit. You helped him, you know, get his parts contributed to the book. And there's actually a wonderful Rolling Stone piece that came out, I think, yesterday that had some nice quotes. Well, nice quotes, meaning of the dark days, you know.
Yeah, so an excerpt of it, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously Chuck's part, thank you for helping get that in
welcome.
The book, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that book, you know, because people go, oh, man, that was one of the best Megadeth records ever, you know. And it's like, what that book tells is the backstory of really how harrowing it was. And I mean, it's one of those records that we wrote in our darkest days, but recorded stone cold sober. And, you know, sometimes people go, well, can you guys just take drugs again for like a year and write another record like that? And it doesn't exactly work like that, you know? So it's, you know, it's a moment that we were able to capture. And of course, we all know of enough other bands who didn't make the turn to sobriety and, you know, either faded out or died along the way. And so I think that to me is aside from the music that came out of it, the success of the human story is to me what really is the story, in my opinion.
So, so are you saying that you wrote kind of the record kind of all messed up on drugs and kind of recorded it sober? Is that because the record came out in September?
Not kind of 100%.
Okay. All right. There you go. I mean,
yeah. No, we wrote it in our darkest days of addiction. And, you know, and it's nice because Slash, you know, Slash was a friend of ours. And by then, we, you know, I became very good friends with Slash. And they were just coming off the Appetite for Destruction tour. And the floodgates of wealth and everything that was soon to be his had not quite happened yet, you know, because royalties start to show up 6 to 12 months after the, you know, after the sales of the record. So, you know, he was getting ready to just be, you know, swimming upstream big time. But in the meantime, he was living in a dingy little apartment behind Tower Records off Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
And he and I connected and we, you know, and he was, you know, admittedly down those same dark roads. And, you know, so we were friends. We'd hang out. We'd do our drugs. We'd play guitar and we became good friends, and he'd come over to the apartment that I had where me and Dave were hanging and, you know, and I'd go over to his place. And that's why it's nice. He wrote the foreword to the book and he gets to tell his what Megadeth meant to him musically. And in fact, the first time I met Slash was at a club in Hollywood called the Cat House.
Mm-hmm.
He came up, I was introduced to him and David, hey, meet Slash. And first thing he says, he goes, man, I love Chris Poland's guitar playing. And he was talking about the Peace Sells album. And that really spoke to me because this was probably during about 1988. And so it really spoke to me that like Slash was a real musician's musician, you know, despite his, you know, kind of imagery that he has of, you know, this kind of, at that time, kind of this wild, loose cannon rock star. He was a real musician, you know, and he really understood the guitar. He was a real student of the guitar. And then when I was hanging with him about a year later, that was even more reinforced, you know. So it was, I had a tape around here. It said Slash with Junior riffs on it. And I listened to it and it wasn't that. So I don't know what happened to these. We had some little riffs and songs and things that we wrote. And, you know, I don't know where they went, but it was a moment, you know. So, but Slash has been just a dear friend to me and certainly to Dave and Megadeth ever since that time.
So you talk about, you know, doing the drugs and everything. And one thing that, you know, now you just mentioned that I helped Chuck read his parts. So I kind of read, you know, a lot of the book and a lot of the what's going on with that. But, I mean, how surprised were you that you lived through it?
You know, to me, it's just part of my, again, because I'm in drug and alcohol recovery, it's a daily thing for me. So I remember those days. It's not like I just closed the door on it and, oh, that was a different guy from another lifetime ago. You know, it's very much an active part of my daily vernacular. And it's interesting when you read it back, it's like I read the audiobook, you know, as Chuck did there with you.
Yeah.
I read the audiobook and it is weird. You know, you're kind of reading it back and it was weird. Some of the emotions kind of came back. Obviously, I sat with the author, Joel Selman, and I told my story to him, and he would ask me questions at certain periods, and I would open up about that. And so, you know, some of those emotions do come back. I mean, this is not something I don't think about the Rust in Peace days every day of my life, you know.
Right, but, right, right.
You know, so, and then to read the audiobook, it brought back some of those. And some of the emotions were not such good ones. You know, there's a lot of strife. There was a lot of, you know, especially in the transition into sobriety, because, you know, Dave and I, here we were, we met over a 12 pack of Heineken in 1983, you know, and then it just, you know, everything that went with it from there, the band and, you know, just that lifestyle. Again, that was 1983 in Hollywood. I mean, come on, that was the height of sex, drugs and rock and roll and debauchery of rock and roll, if there ever was one.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so there we were, you know, putting Megadeth together. So here we are, you know, what, 5 years later, you know, 6 years later, trying to get out of that lifestyle, but yet continue our band, continue our vision. You know, does it even work without the drugs and alcohol? I mean, there's these big question marks over all this
stuff,
you know. And I remember sitting in my apartment in Studio City, excuse me, and I remember just this thought coming to me. I was like, do I even want to keep doing this anymore? And it was like, I mean, it was truly just like a godsend, you know, where this feeling came right out. This thought came and said, you know what? You started playing bass and doing music when you were 11 years old, long before the drugs and the booze showed up. You know, these drugs have just been nothing but a nuisance and gotten in the way of your whole dream. They have to go. The music stays, the drugs go. And I'll never forget it. And it was a revelation. And it seems so obvious, you know, but when you're in those shoes living that life, that's one of the things that, you know, that lifestyle does to you, is it confuses you and it taunts you and tempts you and it corrupts your thinking and your sort of morality and everything about it. And, you know, that to me was the dividing line, because imagine to throw away a gift and everything because you just decide, well, the easier, softer way is just to pick up a crack pipe and put the bass down and I'll just ride off into the sunset. And that is what happens to so many. So again, you know, maybe being raised a good little Lutheran kid over in Jackson, Minnesota, probably had some influence, and it probably helped at that critical moment, you know?
Well, I tell people all the time, it's like, you know what? I know a lot of rock stars, but I also know a lot of good people. And it's like, you're one of the good people, and I'm glad that you kicked it. And, you know, you're a really good guy. And it's like, you know, I'm a fan, of course, obviously. And, you know, we've become friends over the past few years. But tell me about this record when you're writing Rust in Peace. How much of it was left over that might have ended up on Countdown, or did you guys empty the tank?
None of it, man. Oh. It was, we tapped the tank. And, you know, it's funny, when we were on the So Far So Good So What tour, we would always write a little bit, and then at soundcheck we'd write, and then we'd kind of, you know, have the front of house sound engineer recorded little bits and pieces of it. And, you know, we went home from the tour, and we went, which the last show was what's now called the Download Festival. Back then it was just the Castle Donington Monsters of Rock Festival. And we had played there, that was early August, I believe, and went home. Me and Dave went to rehab for a couple of days, and that didn't stick. And so we left. And
that was August of 1989?
88, actually.
88. Oh, okay.
And,
okay.
And then we went, yep, then we went in, me, Dave, and things were not working out with Jeff Young. I mean, he was there to play on that So Far So Good So What record, did the tour, but things were, you know, clearly we were not a sort of just a lifestyle fit, you know. So it was really me, Dave, and Chuck Beeler. So we went in the studio, to a rehearsal studio, and we rewrote Holy Wars, Tornado of Souls, and Polaris. It wasn't even called Rest in Peace yet. It was just Polaris. And so we went into a studio in North Hollywood, and we cut those three tracks as a demo in December of 88. And it's funny, I do actually have those demos here and there.
Really?
A bunch of different, we had a bunch of different versions, and it wasn't called Tornado of Souls. Dave had a lyric on it called Child Saint, which was, I remember, was a title he had from back when I met him in 83, and he was just kind of kicking the idea around. There's a vocal, you know, take of him, you know, kind of just fishing around for an idea and a melody and everything. But Holy Wars was done. I mean, that song has been done from the day it was written.
Chuck helped you guys demo that out.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. In fact, there's a version on the Megadeth War Chest box set that is from a demo, and that's Chuck. So that has actually been released.
Okay.
I forgot that it was actually on War Chest. And then through 89, we called Dimebag Darrell about maybe joining the band. And he was Diamond Darrell then. He was not yet
right.
Dimebag.
Right.
Was,
yep.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
And because I'd met him the previous summer, summer of 88, in Dallas, Texas, when I was down there with a girlfriend that I had at the time. And I loved Pantera. They were great. I jumped up on stage and jammed Peace Cells with them. And man, those guys could drink. They could drink a lot and still play really good. Megadeth.
I was going to say,
we couldn't do that.
Yeah, if Diamond VP would have joined your band, you guys would have kicked the drugs and stuff, but the alcohol would have killed you.
Well, and that's what he said. He goes, listen, along with me comes my brother.
Right.
And Chuck was still our drummer. We didn't need a drummer. And so, again, it was just a great conversation. And then, you know, again, a year later, or, you know, not even a year later, look what happened. They came out with Cowboys from Hell.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, they turned the world on its ear themselves. So, yeah, look, things happen for a reason. We also had up Jeff Waters from Annihilator. But Jeff's man was taken off, too. And he was, you know, obviously a leader in his own right. And so that probably would have never worked anyway, even though he's a good friend of ours today, you know.
Along the line, you asked Slash, right? Or no?
Well, we did. When in late 80, yeah, around that exact time. I mean, we just brought it up as like, hey, not for nothing. I don't know. What do you think? You want to jam? What do you think about being in Megadeth? And you know, it was a serious moment. Yet it was, you know, kind of almost rhetorical. And you know, again, it's kind of like, I don't know. Let's put it out to him. I mean, me and Dave talked about it. It's like, should we ask him? And I think Dave brought it up. And you know, again, Slash is our friend, and of course he's in Guns N' Roses, who are quickly becoming the biggest band in the world. And you know, they themselves, of course, had their own, you know, unrest inside the band. And,
oh, they did. I never heard about that. But anyways,
yeah,
we'll talk about that later.
Know, so, yeah. And you know, so it wasn't like we were trying to split the band up or anything, but it was just that moment. And you know, and it was just kind of a moment that was like, you know, thanks for thinking of me, you know, love you guys. I just don't think now's the time, kind of one of those. And we just kind of let it go. And that was it, you know. And you know, just remained friends. So that was fine, you know. But yeah, I mean, then look, we went through the rest of 89 writing the rest of the record. Nick Menza then came into the band because Chuck, you know, Chuck was not able to get clean at that time. And well, me and Dave weren't yet either, but there was very much a move that it's like, look, we got at least head, we got to try, you know? And, you know, it's funny because Chuck is still one of our best friends of the legacy. You know, he's comes to the shows when we come through town. He'll sit, you know, Joe Louis Arena at the last show. I remember he's sitting backstage behind Dirk, just hanging back there watching him play. And, you know, so he's, you know, he's a dear friend to us, you know, still to this day. But Nick Menza came into the band, and that was a good needed lift for us. You know, Nick, I always said Nick's kind of like the Tommy Lee of thrash metal. You know, he's animated, a lot of energy. He was very athletic. And, you know, I got to say, he and his girlfriend, Stephanie, at that time, they really helped me turn the corner by late 89. You know, he was into mountain bike riding, and he got me, you know, as we started with Cutting the Rust and Peace record, you know, me and him and our producer, Mike Klink, we'd go out and play tennis. Me and Nick would go bike riding. Nick got me into a healthy lifestyle, you know, and that helped me come out of the darkness, you know. But yeah, 89 was just really us writing the rest of the record. And assuming, look, we might end up just doing this a three piece like we did So Far, So Good, So What. We'll just have to hire some guy to come in and tour with us. But, you know, as we turned the corner into 1990, actually, ironically, we're cutting the demos for Rust in Peace in December of 89. And at this little studio in Hollywood, and downstairs was a kind of a high rise tower. And downstairs is where our manager, Ron Lafitte's office was. And we went down to his office one night, me and Dave did, after, you know, from the studio, we just went down to his office, and there were these two records on his desk, Cacophony and Dragon's Kiss, and with this guy, Marty Friedman. And we were like, Marty Friedman. And we're like, that's that guy that played in that band Hawaii. And Ron said, he goes, look, I've been telling you guys, this guy has been asking for an audition for like 6 months, you know? And me and Dave just kind of like, why not? We've auditioned 20 other guys that haven't worked. Why not? You know? So really, it was just kind of like flip a coin. Why not? You know? So we had him come down in, it was probably late January of 90, like a month later, we had him come down and we did an audition, and he, you know, he played well. Nobody walked in and played these songs perfectly. There's just no way you could unless you're in the room with us. But he was about 75%, you know, and he most importantly, he looked cool. He had the right attitude. And it's like if you put us in a lineup of me, Dave, Nick, and Marty, we looked like a freaking band, you know, and, you know, we thought the same. We all like to eat sushi. I mean, you know what I mean? It was just kind of one of those moments where it's like, God, we're like, we can hang. Like, this is a hang. And anybody who's listening to this, you know, who's in a band, you know that being able to hang is 75% of the deal. You know, at some point the music, you know, becomes, obviously it's the most important to the public, but when you're rolling day to day, 24 hours a day together, you know, can you hang out? I mean, that's, it's like a marriage, you know. If you can't hang out and have fun and do anything cool together, it's pretty hard to stay married, you know.
So back in those days, like you guys went on the Clash of the Titans tour in 91. I saw it, you know, with the Alice in Chains and Slayer and Anthrax and you guys. But back in the day, this band called Metallica was really making some big waves. Did that play on you guys? Did that put any pressure on you guys? To, you know, especially with Dave, you know, having been kicked out of the band. I suppose you can't speak for him, but are you guys watching that and kind of the mirror and your peripheral and checking them out?
Oh, of course. I mean, look, we are all just a branch off the Metallica family tree. I mean, let's face it; those guys, you know, especially Megadeth with Dave being there, and then me being a branch off of Dave with Megadeth, you know. So, I mean, look, we owe everything to Metallica. I mean, those guys broke down the doors for every one of us. Anthrax, Slayer, you know, bands today, Lamb of God, you know, Pantera. Like, none of this would have happened without Metallica being up there as the 800-pound gorilla just carving the path through the jungle that would have never let heavy metal in. I mean, they just, it just, the stuff that they were able to do and you know, the size and the scope of which they were able to break those doors down, you know, it changed all of our lives, you know, as musicians, as fans, as everything. And, you know, that's why I think when they did the Big Four with us in 2010 and 11, I mean, that was just such a great olive branch. You know, like Scott Ian said, it's like we're all brothers of the same family. It's just that one of our brothers went off and became Microsoft, you know, and that was Metallica, you know. It's like, how the hell did you do that? Like, that's amazing. You changed the world, you know. But it's, you know, the fact that they came back and, you know, just sort of, you know, again, offered that olive branch to us and just said, hey, you know, we were all in this together, you know, let's celebrate what we did together so many years ago. And you know, that I think that speaks volumes to just how cool Metallica is.
So how much Rust in Peace, like, memorabilia do you have? Do you have any, like, you know, basses you played or anything that you saved from that era?
I don't have any of the gear. You know, in 1998 or so, we did a big auction on Megadeth.com because we stored the gear. It was actually here in Phoenix. It was a trucking company that was based out of here. So we had just tons of guitars and old speaker cabinets and stage sets and all kinds of stuff that just, you know, we had no use for it. So we auctioned it off to the fans. And it's funny that one of the fans, when we did in 2010, when I came back to Megadeth and we did the 20th anniversary of the Rust in Peace tour, you know, Dave and I talked about it. It's like, let's make this look exactly like 1990, you know. Me and Marty Friedman went to go see the Kiss reunion in 1996, you know, and
which started right here in Detroit.
Yeah, and we knew the building manager here in Phoenix, so he gave us, like, second row dead center, you know. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting there, you know, watching, you know, and it was basically like the Kiss Alive 2 set, I think, right? It was
right.
Kind of similar to that. And you know, I thought, this is how you do it. Like, it's obviously got to be a bit more modernized because it's modern day, but you're really taking people back in time to that whole period. And so for me, with the Rust in Peace thing, I was like, this needs to mirror what we did in 1990 and 91. And so Dave actually knew the woman in Hollywood who bought the backdrop. So we called her up and we actually got the original backdrop back. So when we started the tour, the thing is, you know, now 20 years old, so it was starting to fray and fall apart. So we actually had to have a new one made partway through the tour. Which didn't look as good, I might say. But the original one, it was so cool that we had that and we did the set carts and, you know, we framed it up with the boxes like on the, you know, on the cover of the record. And, you know, I wanted the same thing. That's when I went back, started playing Jackson basses, my Harkey amps. It was all about stretch jeans and, you know, wristbands. And I was like, I want, when people would come and see this, I want them to be taken back in time to 1990. And Dave, you know, he had his bullet belt, put the white shirt on again, and you know, we still look, I think, pretty good, you know, for all that we've been through. So it's, you know, you come in and, you know, it's yeah, Megadeth's not like fat and bald and, you know, trying to relive a glory day. It's like, yeah, those are the guys. There it is, you know. And I think probably one of my favorite memories was we played in San Antonio at the AT&T Center. It was a couple of months later. It was in the summer. We were on tour with Slayer, Megadeth. We're doing a run. And so we're playing in the arena there. And I remember seeing these kids in the front row. And, of course, they probably got their Megadeth shirts from Hot Topic, you know. Because, you know, they're modern day kids. You know,
right, right.
Millennials, right? So they're in the front. And they're probably 14, 15 years old. And they're looking up at us. Like, oh my God, that's them right there. That's Megadeth. You know, you could just see the look in their eye. And then behind them was the next generation, and up in the seats were the kind of the third generation, you know, mm-hmm. I remember that night too, because somebody threw some cup of something on me and I was like, that's warm and smells like pee. Like, did someone just throw a cup of piss on me?
Man.
Yeah, it was kind of disgusting, but I was like, well, that's rock and roll, you know?
So they
used to throw bottles and knives and bullets at us. So I guess if I'm only getting urine thrown on me, I guess we're improving here.
And that was only here in Detroit. So.
Exactly. So
if you had to pick like some of your favorite songs off of this record, I mean, what are your like top two or three?
You know, I always loved Five Magics.
Yeah.
I've played it at a lot of clinics. To me, as a bass player, it's kind of the, you know, it's that one song that has everything and the kitchen sink thrown in, you know. It has all of the, and it's super fast. It's to me, it's the showstopper on the record. Of course, I'm kind of partial to Dawn Patrol because I wrote the, you know, the music to that. And it's, I guess, technically the only ballad on Rusted Teeth.
whose vocals is that?
That's Dave.
It is
Dave.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because Nick had a track called My Creation, and I had a song which, you know, would become Dawn Patrol. And it was just music. Actually, Nick had music and lyrics, I think, and mine was just this bass riff. And because Mike Klink, the producer, while we were cutting the record, he kept looking over at me. He goes, "So you guys only have 7 songs, right?" And I get this very kind of inquisitive manner about him. And he goes, "You don't have any more?" And I said, "Nah, this is it." He says, "You could probably use one more, you know." And I said, "Well, I don't know how that's going to happen. I mean, you know, here we are, you know." And I said, "Well, I said I do have this one riff. I actually wrote it on a bass that from Jimmy Bain, who played in Dio. He had loaned me this 8-string bass of his, and I took it home and I wrote this riff on it." And I said, "Well, why don't you lay it down? And when Dave comes in, we'll show it to him." And so I had Nick play drums to it, and I put it down. It's just it's the same riff. It just loops over and over and over for
a minute and a half.
And Nick put his idea down, and we showed them both to Dave, and Dave seemed more partial to Dawn Patrol, and he put the lyric down and called it Dawn Patrol, and that made the record. And that literally was at the 11th hour.
Mm.
That was
What was the last song you put on then? You said 7. There's 9 songs on the record,
or whatever it was.
Oh, okay,
gotcha. 9. Yeah. So, Klink would say, "Hey, you only got 8 songs. We could use one more." So yeah, that became song 9. And you know, it's funny, Tornado of Souls, which we, you know, has stayed in the live set pretty much, you know, all the years. It's the weirdest thing, 'cause it's got this quirky, sort of rhythm to it. It's not just a hard driving kind of 4 on the floor, you know, like symphony or something, you know, which has this just easy to follow groove. It's kind of got this herky jerky groove to it. But the fans love it, and it just creates this monster mosh pit in the big festivals, and so we keep it in the set, and the fans, they sing every word. So it's one of these just oddities that has stayed in the set, and you know, so I don't know. There's a couple. I mean, they're all great. I really every song on that record is they're fun to play. The fans love them when we play them, and you know, so it's just kind of this perfect moment in time.
Yeah, speaking of that, it takes me back to when I started in my radio career, which would be 30 years ago. I think I did my first shift in 1990 in March, right around the time you were getting sober. I did my first shift, and I played Holy Wars and Hangar 18 when they were brand new on the radio, so it's it always meant a little bit something to me as well. But hey, a couple more things here, and we'll cut you loose. And as always, it's so good to catch up with you. I got a question from a fan. Who's a better driver, your manager, agent, friend Tom Hazard or Bumblefoot?
Driver as in like in the car?
Yeah, Bumblefoot sent that to me.
Well, you know, it's funny, I was just thinking, I'm going, when did Bumblefoot drive? Because I remember on the tour I did most of the driving. I don't think he drove. You know, he did drive. He might have driven me home from B.B. King's in New York back to my hotel in New Jersey, I think. And it's funny, that's a toss-up, man. I did a lot of miles with Tom behind the wheel. And Tom, for as rough and woolly as he is, he's actually a pretty good driver. I'll give him that. But I tell you what, if I had to go the long haul, Ron's a pretty safe driver, man. I mean, for as much of a lunatic musician as he is, he's very conservative. He's very safe and keeps it between the lines. You know, you're not going to die when you're in the car with Bumblefoot.
All right.
I think this might have to go to Bumblefoot. Yeah.
All right, final thing here for you. I know that we talked a lot about you know, Rust in Peace and what you got, you know, what you guys did back in the day, but like I said before, you're one of the busiest people I know. So you just did this jam. You just texted me with the, with, you know, that with Sepultura guys, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what else do you have going on? Can you narrow it down in the next 27 minutes?
Sure. Yeah. No, well, so my solo band, Ellison, which kind of just formed out of fun and kind of as a hobby, is now turned into kind of a second career.
Yeah.
You know, when Megadeth's on our downtime, I've got this other vehicle I can go jump in and take that around the track. So we have a record called No Cover, and it's 18 cover songs that we did. That's coming out. That'll be out in November. And Chuck Beeler played on it. Dirk Buren. So I had a couple of Megadeth alumni on there. Charlie Benante, Al Jorgensen from Ministry. I mean, really, a Bumblefoot, of course, is on it. So it's really a great record of covers, everything from Sweet, Nazareth, Bachman Turner Overdrive, to Kiss, to Judas Priest, all kinds of great stuff. So that'll be coming out this fall. And then actually working on another solo record of original material, and that'll be coming out in 2021. So just, you know, pivoting and adjusting to the, you know, to the pandemic schedule that we're all now on. And, you know, Megadeth should be ramping up by, you know, next summer, if everything goes as planned with the pandemic. I mean, we're ready. Megadeth's definitely ready. It's just we're now at the, you know, at the beck and call of the world at large, you know. So
how close is the album to being finished?
Yeah, exactly. The album, we're working very hard on the record. Record's coming along great.
Okay.
So that'll be, new record will drop, and then a whole tour will happen around that. Megadeth Lamb of God will be starting up in July, August. And, you know, it's presumably the rest of the world to follow if everybody's healthy and they let us go do what we do, which is go shred and melt faces with Megadeth.
There you go. Well, David, as always, thank you so much for your time and your friendship and talking to me about this classic album, Rust in Peace. And congratulations, September 24th, I think it's the 30th anniversary. And congratulations on your sobriety. I didn't realize it was 30 years, but man, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, thank you, man. I appreciate that. And it's, you know, there's a lot to lose now if I double back. So it's just easier to keep going forward at this point, you know. So, well, thanks for all your support, man. And I appreciate you just helping get Chuck Beeler and getting his audiobook for the audiobook recorded. And so appreciate your friendship. And, of course, Detroit, you know, is one of the first stops that we've ever done, you know, with Megadeth. It's just always a staple on the tour stop, as well as, for me, even my solo shows. You know, it's fun to go back and play the Token Lounge and have Chuck Beeler come up and play with me last year when I came through and did some solo dates. So, you know, Detroit's a home away for home for me, for sure.
David Ellison today in the Talking Rock with Meltdown Podcast, and congratulations to those guys for numerous things, including the 30th anniversary of the record, 30 years of sobriety for David right there. I know a lot of friends in this business that get sober. Thankfully, you know, it seems like it's a tough slog out there in the world of being a rock star. And some people may, you know, cry, well, woe is me. But it's like they get hooked on these things, man. And it is tough. And they relapse. I've had friends relapse. They get back into it then. And I've had friends now 5 years sober, 7 years sober. David, 30 years. I didn't realize he was sober for that long. So congratulations to him. You learn something new every day. And how about those stories? With a David with a Slash and all that. Just some great stuff right there. Hey, hope you guys dug this. Like I said before, subscribe because I've got some pretty cool interviews coming up. I don't like to say who I'm going to be talking to because I don't want to jinx it, because I've actually said it before and they fall through or I lose the recording or whatever the case is. But anyways, just trust me on this one. I've got some cool ones coming up right here on Talkin' Rock.
Thank you for listening to Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. You can help this podcast grow by giving it a 5-star rating and writing a review on Apple and iTunes. Plus, feel free to subscribe and share it with your friends. Until next time, thanks for listening to Talkin' Rock.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.